This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Find out what's new.
What's new?
What's new?
Oceanography,
astronomy,
medicine,
botany,
physics,
evolution,
cosmology,
ecology,
information technology,
genetics,
biotechnology,
mathematics.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine, and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the February 10th edition of SciPod, you can check out, but you can never leave. A new theory suggests our universe is one big black hole. Now you see them. Most people have never heard of the Carteret Islands, but thanks to rising sea levels, they may soon become famous for disappearing off the map. And from laser shoes to smelling in stereo to the baddest dinosaur of them all, we bring you the best of this week's science news. But first, this week's cover story. If you read science fiction, you know that it's bad news to be swallowed up by a black hole. Well, according to one scientist, it's too late to do anything about that. That's because we're already in one. Dr. Paul Wesson is a theoretical physicist at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. And he says that if his calculations are correct, our universe could be one big black hole. New Scientist's Ivan Semenek reached Dr. Wesson this week in Victoria, British Columbia.
Hi, Dr. Wesson.
Hello, how are you?
So, Dr. Wesson, your research suggests there could be life inside black holes because, I guess, if certain mathematical properties apply, we are it.
Well, it could be. I know it's a bit of a far-out idea, but the mathematics does seem to stack up.
Now, before we get to this issue of whether we live inside a black hole or not, can you remind us of the basic astronomical definition of a black hole?
Well, the ordinary kind of black hole is the kind predicted by Einstein's theory. And in it, you've got a very intense gravitational field, and the singularity at the center, which is a place where things screw up, basically, is surrounded by a one-way membrane, hence the name black hole. So that's the standard type of black hole that astronomers are searching for.
And when you say one-way membrane, you mean things can fall in, but they can't come out. That includes light, hence, they look black or they look invisible to us outside.
So the technical name for that is the horizon, and that means basically that it's a one-way thing.
Right. Now, astronomy and science fiction both are full of these images and wonderful illustrations of what a black hole might be like at the center of our galaxy or if a star explodes and collapses into a black hole. That seems very different from the image of a black hole as an entire universe. So, you know, in what way does the universe resemble a black hole?
It can resemble a black hole even in Einstein's theory, and one of my colleagues, Raj Patria, at the University of Waterloo, noticed that way back in the 1970s in a paper in Nature. However, the type that we are looking at now is a higher dimensional version of that, by which I mean we're looking at the analog of black holes in a kind of theory whose motivation is to unify gravity with the forces of particle physics.
Right, and this often involves going to higher dimensions or assuming that the universe is more than just the three-dimensional universe that we're seeing. So what is it that's leading you in this direction? What kind of dimensions are we talking about? What would this higher-order black hole be like?
Our work has mostly had to do with adding one extra dimension to Einstein's theory. So what we're trying to do is to basically take the smallest step away from the standard theory. But we're quite comfortable about that because the five-dimensional version is also what you get if you come down from even higher dimensional versions, like, for example, 10 or 11, which is the kind that particle physicists study. So we're basically trying to do something which is quite conservative from the mathematical point of view.
So we've got, you say, taking one step beyond Einstein. And how does that affect how the black hole behaves?
It affects it quite drastically, as it turns out. I think that most of us assumed when we started to investigate this that the five-dimensional black holes would be quite similar to four-dimensional ones, but most of the models we get are not the same. And if you think about it, you will then appreciate why, because in the five-dimensional case, there's an extra dimension that runs at right angles to the ones that we see. So that brings in a lot of complications.
And how do we get from that to the idea that this is a better match for the universe as a whole? I mean, what then leads you to think that a five-dimensional black hole is a kind of analog for our entire universe?
One of the motivations for studying five dimensions from the astronomical side is that we would like to get a better model for the Big Bang. In Einstein's theory, the Big Bang is a kind of initial event, and you can't understand really where the matter comes from. You're just given it, and there's nothing really that you can do to analyze it. In the five-dimensional theory, though, you can actually analyze where the matter comes from. So from that point of view, you're explaining more than you can with the standard theory. So we initially started to do this work from the cosmological side with that idea in our mind, and then I asked my PhD student, Sanjeev Sierra, also at Waterloo, if he could look at these models instead from the point of view of what would happen if the model wasn't just a cosmology, but also a black hole. And after a lot of work, he came back to me with a rather surprising answer, and that is that one of the numbers that you can calculate for the cosmology has got exactly the same value as one of the ones you can calculate for a black hole. And, of course, coincidence has happened, but given the fact that these numbers have got a lot of parameters in them, it seemed to us not just a coincidence, not just a chance thing. So we started to look more, and then we found out that, yes, the two things, the universe and the black hole, do have a lot of similarities.
If it's true, I mean, if this consistency is really indicating some physical reality, and our universe is, in fact, the inside of a black hole, does that mean that, we are a black hole in some larger universe, in someone else's universe?
It could well be, yes. And a lot of people now have taken this farther, including a group of Chinese cosmologists led by a colleague of mine, Hongye Liu, and also a Czechoslovakian master's student that I had working with me. And they have all come to the conclusion that we can, if we wish, see ourselves as inside a five-dimensional black hole, and we get virtually the same agreement with astronomical observations. But then, of course, you get to the mind-bending bit of trying to imagine what that means from outside, and that's a real challenge.
And if that black hole is inside another universe, perhaps that universe is in turn a black hole inside another universe. Does it go on ad infinitum?
It could in principle do that, because Einstein's equations don't tell you any sacrosanct value of the dimensionality. So although people like to choose particular numbers, and 10 and 11 are popular, or higher ones like 26 if you want to go up that far, there is in fact no unique value.
Well, I think if anyone needed their mind boggled, you've just done them a great service. It's a really mind-boggling concept, isn't it?
I think it's a very interesting concept. I'm not necessarily saying that it is correct, but certainly from the mathematical point of view, you can see the universe and a black hole as being the same thing. Whether or not that's something that we can get our minds around, after all, I've been doing relativity for 30 years, and I still find this a challenge.
Well, I hope the science fiction writers out there will be sending some royalties your way.
Well, I'd be grateful for them.
Thanks very much, Dr. Wesson.
You're welcome. Bye.
And if you're feeling in the dark about all of this, there is a remedy. Paul Wesson has written an article explaining his theory, and it's this week's cover story in New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now, here is Donna Page and Jeffrey Whittle with this week's science news.
Move over, T-Rex. It looks like there's a new candidate for the biggest and possibly the baddest predatory dinosaur of them all. It's called Spinosaurus, and it lived in what is now Africa around 100 million years ago. Newly acquired fossils of the creature suggest it measured about 17 meters, or 55 feet, from nose to tail. That's more than 30% longer than the largest example of Tyrannosaurus rex. Spinosaurus also looked quite different from T-Rex. An investigation of the fossils at the Civic Museum of Natural History in Milan, Italy, suggests its head looked more like that of a crocodile. Its long, interlocking teeth may have been adapted to catching fish. Ironically, its status as the heavyweight predator among dinosaurs could have been discovered sooner. The first and best Spinosaurus specimen was found by German paleontologists in 1912, but that fossil was destroyed during Allied bombing of Munich during World War II.
Researchers have come up with a process that literally prints out a pair of made-to-measure shoes. The innovation could put an end to ill-fitting footwear and could usher in a new era of mass customization. The shoes are built layer by layer using a form of rapid 3D printing in which a laser fuses together particles of a nylon-based material. To produce the personalized footwear, a prospective customer's feet must first be scanned to obtain a digital model. Customers are then recorded while performing exercises to determine the magnitude and distribution of forces acting on their feet. That information is combined with an analysis of foot structure and gait to produce a template for a sole around which the rest of the shoe is based. The system was developed by a London-based company and will be used first to make shoes for elite athletes. But the long-term goal is to get the technology into stores where a pair of form-fitting shoes could be printed up for just about anyone in a matter of hours.
Rats not only have stereo vision and stereo hearing, a new study suggests they can smell in stereo too. The study was conducted at the National Center for Biological Sciences in Bangalore, India. Researchers used brain and nose probes to pinpoint how a rat's olfactory system responds to smell. They found that 90% of the cells in the olfactory region of a rat's brain respond differently depending on whether a scent first entered the left or right nostril. That difference allows the rats to identify where a smell is coming from in just 50 milliseconds.
And finally, men who claim to be sympathetically pregnant in tandem with their pregnant partners may not be taken seriously, but in monkeys at least, the phenomenon seems to be a real one. Scientists at the National Primate Research Center in Madison, Wisconsin, weighed male marmosets and tamarins, both small monogamous primates whose female partners were pregnant. The weighing took place each month from the time the females conceived until the birth of their infants. The results showed that, on average, the monkey dads-to-be added an extra 10% to their body weight during the pregnancy. Scientists say the weight gain may be beneficial. It prepares the males for expending more energy after their partners give birth. See, honey, I told you I need to eat that bag of Oreos. It's for the baby.
We hope you're enjoying this edition of SciPod, and we'd really love to know what you think of our podcast. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us, please complete our short podcast survey. It's easy. Just visit newscientist.com/podcast and follow the links to get the survey. And now, back to our show. It's not news that global warming has led to a worldwide rise in sea level. To most of us, this problem sounds serious but rather academic. We think of it as something future generations will have to deal with if we don't stop pumping carbon into the atmosphere. But there's now one part of the world where the effect of a rising sea level is all too real. The Carteret Islands are about to become uninhabited, with the people who live there scheduled to evacuate over the next 2 years. Now, it's likely you haven't heard much about the Carteret Islands until now, but they have an intriguing history, as Ivan Semenek found out when he spoke to New Scientist History's editor, Stephanie Payne.
Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, Ivan.
Can you tell us about the Carteret Islands? Where are they? What are they like? Who lives there?
The Carteret Islands, well, not many people would be able to place them on the map. They're very, very small. There are six of them around a lagoon. They're essentially just the tops of a coral atoll, so they're only 1 or 2 meters above sea level at best. They are, in fact, part of Papua New Guinea, but the nearest reasonable piece of land is the much bigger island of Bougainville, which is volcanic rather than coral. But that's a four-hour boat ride away.
And now people are leaving the Carteret Islands. Is there no other option for them?
Not really. There are many islands in the Pacific where this will soon be a problem, but for these islanders, things are very desperate. They've had a lot of trouble for at least 20 years or more, as sea level's been rising and stormy weather brings much higher waves over the islands. They've lost their crops. They can't plant things because the soil's become salty. They've tried building seawalls, they've tried planting mangroves, all the usual things to defend against the sea. But it's a losing battle.
Let's go back a bit into history. The Carteret Islands are not a household name, at least not yet, although given what's going on, we might soon be hearing more about them. Was there a Mr. Carteret at some point that lent his name to these islands?
There was indeed. His name was Philip Carteret, and he was a navigator in the late 1700s.
So this is the time of exploration in the Pacific, I suppose.
Well, the whole of Europe was rushing madly around the South Seas looking for what they really wanted to find was a great southern continent, which for centuries people had believed existed, which in fact turned out to be mythical. But Carteret was one of many voyagers who were sent off to have a look and see what they could find and claim it for his own country. He was in command of a second ship that was supposed to tag along with the main expeditionary force, which was a ship called the Dolphin. And his commanding officer was one Samuel Wallis. Well, Captain Wallis had a fantastic ship. It was beautifully fitted out for travels anywhere around the world. But poor Philip Carteret was given a terrible little ship, very small, in bad condition. It had been languishing and rotting even up the Thames for about 30 years. And he couldn't believe that he could possibly be asked to go on a voyage of exploration. So when the two boats were sent off out to sea, he assumed that he was only going as far as the South Atlantic and no further. Somebody else would take on the job of exploring the Pacific. But when he got there, he found he too was going in this lousy ship. And his job was to navigate the two ships through the Strait of Magellan, which is a very nasty piece of water. It normally takes about 2 months. And the Swallow was such a bad ship, it took them 4 months. And when they got to the exit, with the Pacific before them, Wallis in his fine ship put up every sail he'd got and sped off over the horizon, leaving Carteret behind.
That seems remarkable that he would just essentially take off like that. I mean, do you think he was expecting that Carteret's ship wouldn't last?
Well, Carteret always thought, and he survived, to tell the tale. He always thought that Wallis was so fed up with being held back by the Swallow that he just took off and decided to do it on his own. Wallis said no, he was just trying to get his ship out of dangerous waters. And so there was a long-running dispute later when they were back in England about which one of them hadn't done their duty and who'd abandoned whom and such like.
So now Carteret finds himself on his own, having come through the Straits of Magellan with the Pacific open before him, but obviously in an inferior quality ship. So what does he decide to do?
Well, by rights, he had every excuse to say, well, I think I'll turn around and go back again. His ship really wasn't fit for ocean voyaging. But he was an adventurous young man and decided, well, maybe if he went on and tried to find new lands, he might make a name for himself. So he did. And in fact, he was very successful despite this dreadful ship. He was short of men, short of gear. Wallis had even run off with all the trade goods, the beads and trinkets that they would have used to trade with islanders. So he decided to go on and he headed off west across the Pacific. And in fact, he went much further south than any other voyager before him. So he did achieve quite a lot.
And what was it that he found there? Any place that we would recognize today?
Well, he found quite a few islands. The one that people are probably most familiar with, but which at the time was no big deal, was Pitcairn Island, which is now famous because that's where the mutineers from the Bounty hung out for about 19 years.
And then how do we get to the Carteret Islands? By this time, I guess if we're talking about Papua New Guinea, we're getting right to the eastern Pacific now.
I think his ambition was to get to the known world, Java and the areas held by the Dutch, as quickly as possible. But he hoped to find places where he could pick up food on the way. So as he passed various islands, he basically just jotted them down, marked them on his map, and headed off. And the Carteret Islands come into that category.
So he did eventually get back to England after this voyage. Was there any impact of the voyage? Did it contribute at all to the understanding of the world or to what would come after?
It did, but it didn't make much impact. The problem, perhaps the worst misfortune of Carteret's life, was that as he was making his way home, Captain James Cook was setting out for the Pacific, and Captain Cook solved all the problems that they'd all been asked to solve. He proved that there was no great southern continent, at least not one that you could live on comfortably. And when he came home, he was the nation's hero, and all those people who had voyaged before him were basically forgotten.
So I guess we have Captain Cook to blame for why the Carteret Islands are not a household word. Of course, now they're coming into prominence because of the sea level issue. What will happen to these islands? I mean, how serious is the sea level rise? Will they disappear completely or simply become less and less habitable?
Well, if the models are right, they probably will disappear altogether within a decade, 10 years. That's really not very long. But before then, they really will become uninhabitable. The islands will be divided up. All the areas where there is some soil will be flooded with salt water. People won't be able to grow anything. Not even coconut trees are going to survive.
And at that point, I guess Carteret will not only disappear from memory, but disappear off the map.
I guess it will, which is a shame, because he really was a very good navigator who... He had terrible time on this voyage, and yet he brought his ship home.
And remembered in the pages of New Scientist.
Of course.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, for telling us this story.
Well, thank you.
Stephanie Payne is in London. You can read her story about the discovery of the Carteret Islands in this week's edition of New Scientist.
Subscribe to New Scientist magazine, and every week you'll enjoy a comprehensive roundup of the latest science and technology news, along with a listing of the best science jobs from around the world. Subscribe today and you'll save 40% off our annual price and get unlimited free access to the entire content of newscientist.com. To take advantage of this offer, just visit www.newscientist.com/2504. That's newscientist.com/2504 for the week's best ideas delivered right to your door.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the February 11th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, the bigger they are, the better they stand. 4.5 years after the collapse of the World Trade Center, engineers are looking at ways to make skyscrapers safer. And now, the HealthCast. Epidemiologists and meteorologists are teaming up to predict exactly when and where people will fall ill. And make me a hippogator. Futurist Freeman Dyson ponders the coming age of do-it-yourself genetic engineering. And you thought the kids were spending too much time on the internet. All this plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.